Welcome to Bina, KALW's program featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. In this series, we bring you remarkable artists and thinkers who've come to speak at the JCCSF as part of our Arts and Ideas program. On this edition of Bina, our guest is science journalist and author Carl Zimmer. He's joined in conversation by journalist, editor, and author Anna Lee Newitz. And now, join Maggie Grabmeier on stage at the JCCSF as she introduces Carl Zimmer and Anna Lee Newitz.
Carl Zimmer writes the Celebrated Matter column for the New York Times and teaches science at Yale University. He's the award-winning author of 13 books about science, including Parasite Rex, Evolution, The Triumph of an Idea, and Microcosm, E. coli, in the New Science of Life. His newest book, She Has Her Mother's Laugh, The Powers, Perversions, and Potential of Heredity, was named a notable book of the year by the New York Times Book Review and the best science book of 2018 by The Guardian. In the book, Zimmer explores the most intimate mystery of all, how our ancestors help make us who we are. She Has Her Mother's Laugh traces the history of heredity as a scientific question and a cultural touchstone. Weaving historical and current scientific research, his own experience with his two daughters, and the kind of original reporting expected of one of the world's best science journalists, Zimmer unpacks urgent bioethical quandaries arising from new biomedical technologies, but also longstanding presumptions about who we really are and what we can pass on to our future generations. Carl's joined by sci-fi and nonfiction writer Anna Lee Newitz. They're the author of the novel Autonomous, nominated for the Nebula and Locus Awards and winner of the Lambda Literary Award. As a science journalist, they're a contributor to the New York Times opinion section and have written for New Scientist, Washington Post, Slate, Popular Science, Ars Technica, The New Yorker, and The Atlantic, among others. Their new novel, The Future of Another Timeline, is out now. So please welcome Carl Zimmer and Anna Lee Newitz. All right, thanks for coming out.
Thank you.
So I wanted to start by talking a little bit about the frame story for this book, because the title is She Has Her Mother's Laugh, and in the introduction you sort of talk about watching your daughter being born and wondering about kind of her biological inheritance, what she's gotten from you and from a family that you're not even sure where they came from. And then you start talking about the culture that she's coming into. And you talk about holding her while watching the Twin Towers burning. And you sort of end by wondering what kind of cultural inheritance she's going to have. And then I wanted to read, I'm going to read to you
right.
A section from your book that I really love. This is late in the book where you're sort of talking again about culture. And Carl says, "To say that culture is an important part of our lives doesn't really do the word justice. Culture is not a part of our life. We are part of it." And so that's one of the things that's so interesting in this book, is I feel like you really straddle the line between talking about the science around heredity, but also all of the cultural baggage that we bring to it. So I wondered if you could start us off by talking a little bit about how our cultural presumptions and our history of understanding what heredity is, how that shaped the direction of modern science and how that sort of shaped what people chose to study.
So when I was starting to do some research for the book, I was reading some work by historians of science, and I just thought, like, well, what have they found out about sort of the history of heredity? And what a number of them said just flat out was that heredity as a scientific question did not exist before the 1800s. And I was like, what? How could that be? Like that, because like for us, like heredity is everything, and everybody gets their 23andMe test, and it just we just live and breathe heredity in a very particular kind of heredity. And so I was like, well, gosh, like if people didn't think about themselves in terms of heredity the way we do, then what were they thinking? And you know, they were thinking in very different ways, and they would talk about blood, like really, like they somehow really thought that you had the same blood as your parents. I mean, like how that worked, who knows? There were debates about whether the inheritance was only from the father. you know, that the mother was just sort of this fertile field for the seed of the father. this was really good for centuries in the West, you know. And of course, like the way Western cultural ideas about heredity were very different than ideas elsewhere. So there was, you know, anthropologists have looked at, I think it's in Malaysia, where there's been a lot of research on a group of people who believe that the reason that children in a family are related is not because they descend from the same parents, but because they eat the same food. That it makes them, they're composed of the same stuff. So you're like, oh, okay, like that's different. So then to sort of see how a science called genetics emerges, in the 19th century into the 20th century, with also sorts of false starts, you know, Charles Darwin just getting it completely wrong. I mean, you got a lot of things right. This one totally blew it. It became much more interesting to me as a sort of a cultural history with science in it.
What was it that Darwin got really wrong? And was that because of sort of cultural presuppositions or?
I think it was just that nobody could really quite get the idea of a gene. Because the thing is that a gene is a very strange concept in that, like, that we carry something and we pass that thing down to, if we have children, we pass that down to them. But the gene is different than sort of the outward manifestation, you know. So there's this very fuzzy connection between the two.
Mm-hmm.
That's a hard thing to get. And Mendel totally, like, stumbled across it. Didn't really know what to make of it. Nobody else did. They said, you've gotten that pattern with pea plants. Why don't you try some other plants? He picked one that has a crazy reproductive system, so totally blew it. And then it was all forgotten for decades. So there's Darwin thinking, like, okay, how am I going to explain this? And so he had this idea that there were particles, gemmules, he would call them, and they would stream out of the cells in your body, and they would go down into the eggs or the sperm, and somehow those particles would sort of reflect the person in miniature, and then they'd be passed down to the next generation. And his cousin was really super, Francis Galton was super enthusiastic about this, and he was a big Darwin disciple, and he tried to test this with rabbits, like sort of transferring blood from one rabbit to another and seeing if they gave birth to different colored rabbits. And it was a complete failure. And Darwin was really annoyed, I think, because he didn't expect anyone to actually, like, test this, let alone his let alone his cousin. And so he actually, like, in print was like, well, that's not exactly what I meant. And so, you know, anyway, it was not a good line on Darwin's CV. Yeah.
Yeah. So, as we move forward into the 20th century, a lot of the ideas that were coming out of the idea of heredity kind of led into eugenics and a whole field of science, or a field that called itself science, that was really devoted to thinking about different racial groups and their characteristics, which kind of fits into eugenics, but it's also its own thing. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and sort of how, you know, often when we talk about the history of genetics and the study of genetics, people like to sort of say, like, well, eugenics was just this weird little thing that happened.
Oh, yeah, never mind the eugenics.
Yeah, never mind that. That wasn't important. You know, the history of racism is not relevant here. But you really foreground it in your book, and you kind of talk about it again and again as being kind of formative for the field in a lot of ways. So I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that and your choice to kind of address it head on and say, like, here's where eugenics fit into this history.
Well, I think we've just sort of conveniently let that all get forgotten. But the fact is that there are people who were legitimately, you know, pioneers and architects of the science of heredity. Scientists today still use their methods. And they were great scientists, and they were also, in many cases, raging racists and people who thought that all sort of human merit and so on was all completely inherited, and therefore that justified why they were on top.
Mm-hmm.
Francis Galton, Exhibit A. the person who coined the word eugenics. And he actually thought that eugenics was a good thing in the sense that, like, he wanted to encourage people of merit to have lots of kids. He was not into, like, killing people off, but he was saying, oh, we'll just foster this, and he would say, like, what a galaxy of genius we will create. So he had this very sunny view of eugenics, if you can imagine that. And of course, you know, he also, like, used his sort of emerging understanding of heredity to try to justify sort of the hierarchy in England. You know, well, intelligence must be totally inherited, and therefore, like, anyone who is rich and successful must be intelligent and have inherited that. And that their races were distinct, and there was a hierarchy as well, and that science could prove this all. So he was all very open about that. So you can't just sort of say, like, let's not talk about that. I mean, that was, like, part of what he did. And yet, there are these basic concepts. I mean, actually, like, in a way, like, Galton is important not just for heredity, for, like, anybody uses statistics. I mean, he envisioned things like correlation, like, because he wanted to compare one generation to the next. It's all him. There are lots of these incredibly complicated figures in the history of heredity, and we just have to look at them for who they are. You know, the United States was full of eugenicists, and they were not at the fringes. They were at the center of the scientific enterprise, and Nazi biologists and doctors would look to work that was being done in the United States as evidence for what they wanted to do. They would cite the work that had been done in the United States. So you have to see that, and you have to kind of see, well, what happened to eugenics? And, you know, maybe we can talk about this later, but, like, are we dealing with eugenics now in a new kind of guise? Like, you have to see that ugly history if you don't want to repeat it.
Yeah, it's really true. And I mean, Margaret Sanger was another person who was a eugenicist, and she was, you know, also famous for helping to found Planned Parenthood. And so, yeah, there's just this really complicated history. I'm wondering what happened that sort of teased apart the eugenics strand from what we would now call sort of legitimate studies of heredity. Like, how did they kind of break apart? And what is now, when we talk about things like inheriting intelligence or races having certain traits, like, how does mainstream science look at that now?
Well, it took a long time for eugenics to really kind of fall away, but it is striking that, say, in the 1910s and 1920s, you would have these leading scientists like Thomas Hunt Morgan, for example. So he got the Nobel Prize for working out chromosomes and trying to understand how genes are in chromosomes, and he studied fruit flies. And people still study fruit flies because Morgan studied fruit flies a century ago. And he learned a lot of things about how genes work. And he would be interested in, like, seeing, you know, he would find a fly that suddenly had a red eye, and he would breed it, and that red eye would get passed down through the generations. And so in one of his books on genetics in the 20s, he's like, so, okay, I study flies, and, you know, the color of an eye is really complicated. Like, there are a bunch of genes I've found that influence the color of an eye. And each one of those genes might also do something else in the fly's body. And the environment, you know, if you raise the fly in the cold or the heat, that changes how the fly behaves too. That's just a fly. Now, there are all these people who want to say, like, oh, intelligence is completely genetic and blah, blah, blah. And, you know, I don't think you have this figured out. And I think maybe all you people would be better off actually just trying to, like, improve the living conditions of people who are poor. How about that? So that was in the 20s. But unfortunately, it took quite a while for that to really take. He laid it all the problems out. I mean, it just leaving aside all the ideology, just the science that people will use for eugenics just doesn't work.
Mm-hmm. So I wanted to go back deep into history now for a mm-hmm. moment before we move forward into the future of genetics and all the cool technology that's being developed. So there's a moment in this book where you take a journey into your own genetic past.
Yes.
And as a science fiction writer, I very much enjoyed this moment when one of the scientists says, like, well, we discovered that you're part alien. And so now you know Carl is part alien. So tell us a little bit about your tell us a little bit about your journey to discovering that alien part and what that was about, like what you kind of discovered about, not just your immediate past,
right,
but your very deep past.
So a scientist got in touch with me and said, do you want to get your genome sequenced? And I was like, whoa. And this is a little bit different than something like 23andMe. That's where basically 23andMe will look at maybe 1 in 1,000 positions in your DNA. He was saying, like, we're doing this program where some people can get the whole thing sequenced. And I was like, yes. And so they did that, but it was done as sort of a medical test. So I had to have a clinical geneticist sign off and then deliver me the results. And my results were like, you're fine. I was like, really? Like, I have been waiting all my career for this moment. And like, and you know, plus I'd like to write about this, and that's super boring. Yeah. And they were like, well, you sound upset. Like, I mean, like, you don't want an interesting genome, you know, like all sorts of rare diseases. You don't want that. And I was like, well, could I get the data? And they're like, no. And because it's a medical test, they don't want to give you the raw data, blah, blah, blah. But we figured out a way where I could get my hands on it. So a hard drive shows up at my door. And I start going to scientists and saying, like, help, like, just let's take a look at this. And so one of the scientists I went to is someone named Adam Siepel, and he's at Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, ironically enough, the former home of the Eugenics Records Office, but now they do much better stuff. And anyway, he studies Neanderthals. So there's DNA in Neanderthals fossils, and so you can compare it to human DNA. And,
can you pause for a second?
Sure.
Can you explain to everyone how the heck we get DNA from Neanderthal fossils? These are like 40,000-year-old fossils.
40, 50, 100.
Usually, you know how you get DNA is from, you know, saliva or blood. So how does that work?
There's no blood. There's no Q-tip. But it turns out that bones save little fragments of DNA in them. And you can actually, from a very small sample of bone, if it's well preserved bone, you can get enough DNA to reconstruct the entire, sometimes the whole genome of an individual. The record now is 700,000 years ago for a horse. Yeah,
isn't that awesome?
So cool. And they're weird. They're not much like horses today. That's the cool thing. So the Neanderthals. So we have several Neanderthal genomes now, and lots of shorter fragments. So we have getting a pretty good idea about Neanderthals. And the interesting thing is that if you are have non-African ancestry in you, you are between 1% and 3% Neanderthal. That's just a fact.
White people are Neanderthals, is what he's saying.
And East Asians.
That's true.
And South Asians. And Australians, Aboriginals, Pacific Islanders, and everyone in the Americas.
Okay.
Basically, everybody except Africa. And maybe them too. But
yeah.
The thing is that basically what happened is our species was in Africa, just Africa, for a long time. And then a small group expanded out and met Neanderthals. Repeatedly and
and lovingly.
I'm not going to speculate on the nature of the Congress, but there were kids, and they were clearly incorporated into human society. Like this, you know, a child who is half Neanderthal, half modern human. You know, their common ancestors over 500,000 years older.
You're listening to science journalist and author Carl Zimmer, whose new book is She Has Her Mother's Laugh. He's joined in conversation by journalist, editor, and author Anna Lee Newitz on Bina, a series featuring creative voices from the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
So the scientists were, I said, like, I want to see, like, what fragments of Neanderthal DNA I have in my genome, because most of it's disappeared. So I was like, show me my Neanderthal DNA. And they're like, okay. And they're, you know, what you do is you sort of compare DNA in these sophisticated ways. And they're like, okay, yeah, all right, that's good. And they're like, whoa, wait, what's this? And I was like, And that's when Siepel said, like, yeah, it looks like you're part alien. And what he meant was that there's a little part of my DNA that corresponds to another kind of extinct human called a Denisovan. So Denisovans, we didn't even know about Denisovans till about, I think it was about 10 years ago. There was these little bits of bone in a cave in Siberia, and it turns out their DNA was not human and not Neanderthal. It was this other thing, Denisovans. And now people are realizing that Denisovans interbred with people in East Asia, New Guinea, Australia. People in New Guinea have a ton of Denisovan DNA. I am not New Guinea. I'm not Papuan. So, like, it was weird to find that. So I don't know if there was some Denisovan encounter in my past, or maybe
tens of thousands of years ago.
Yeah, or yeah. Maybe, or this is the what Siepel said was, now that, you know, it might not be quite that exotic. He's saying maybe a Denisovan and a Neanderthal had a kid, and then that kid or some descendant of that kid then had a child with a human, and basically you got that piece of Denisovan DNA that way. Point being, heredity is complicated, you know. We've got these fragments of DNA that are just floating down through the generations, and they can just end up all over the place. So maybe I'm part Denisovan.
It sounds like you are. I mean, how do you think that changes our understanding of who we are now? Because it seems like almost every week there's a new story that's using genetics or using DNA to figure out more about these ancient love meetings. I'm going to call them love meetings. And how much Homo sapiens, or what we think of as modern humans, really was kind of all over the place.
Yeah.
You know, does that change this neat picture that we were all, that many of us were taught in school, that there was Homo sapiens in Africa, they left Africa, and that was it?
Yeah, well, I think we have this sort of model of human evolution. It goes way back. It's sort of a march of progress. You might have seen that, you know, classic figure, series of figures where it gets taller and taller and taller, and sometimes it hunches down in front of a computer. But it's a line. It's just a line.
Yeah.
And that evolution is happening in that line. But the fact is that, you know, as Darwin said, like, evolution is a tree. Mm-hmm. The human family has lots of branches of populations that kind of separated, got isolated from each other, and then would come back into contact with each other. So that nobody today is a close match to the people who are living there, say, 10,000 years ago. For a long time, you know, people thought that, the San people of southern Africa, who once called the Bushmen of the Kalahari, like, they are sort of the icon of the remnant of the first humans. And, you know, they have an ancestry that branched off a long time ago from other people, but then there was lots of mixing together after a while, so they actually have DNA from the Near East. Mm-hmm. That showed up in Africa about 3,000 years ago. So this idea of a simple march of progress or purity, the science just totally knocks all that over.
So there's no pure Homo sapiens. That's just this kind of untouched, perfect line of Homo sapiens.
And our ancestry kind of radiates outward to Neanderthals, Denisovans. You know, some people think we had sex with even weirder kinds of human-like things. I mean, there's some DNA in some people's genomes where the geneticists are like, what is that? You know?
Well, there's also a lot of new hominins, right?
Yes.
That have been discovered. So the so-called hobbit people, Homo florensis.
Yeah, so that was found, I think, about 15 years ago, maybe now, mm-hmm. on the Indonesian island of Flores. So... And they were they lived until about 60,000 years ago, and they were 3 feet tall, and a very small brain, actually a little taller than 3 feet, as I recall. I wrote a few months ago about another discovery in the Philippines, an island called Luzon, a new species, Homo luzonensis, which was around kind of around the same time, and they were actually smaller, super tiny, tiny people. But like, so, you know, it was a very interesting world, I would say, you know, 60, 70,000 years ago. Lots of different types of humans running around. Mm-hmm. Really small ones, really big ones, you know.
And then a lot of them had culture as well, it seems like, mm-hmm. at least with Neanderthals.
Yeah, right. You know, they were probably wearing jewelry. They were, they were. They would wear necklaces with eagle claws on them. I mean, they were badass. Neanderthals, they hunt dolphins. They did all sorts of things.
They buried their dead.
They left
art behind.
They went way down into caves and turned the stalagmites into these sort of ritual circles. Fascinating, yeah. So if someone makes jokes about your Neanderthal ancestry, you just say, like, you don't understand Neanderthals. Yeah. I come from good people.
Yeah, very sophisticated.
That's right.
So one of the things that I've admired about you for a long time is I see you a lot of times on Twitter arguing with people about evolution. And I don't recommend going on Twitter if you haven't been there before just to see this. But if you're there, there's a lot of, let's call it debate, over these questions around evolution. I mean, this is still a very, like, a living issue for a lot of people. You know, there's this, you know, whether evolution is real or what evolution really means. There's a lot of people who believe in this pure Homo sapiens idea. So I'm just wondering, over your time kind of educating people like this, hearing back from people who were skeptics about evolution, have you seen any changes or trends in kind of what's happening with people accepting evolution? Does it seem like people are accepting it less now or more or...
It's a tough question because, like, the survey data is not great. I mean, people don't ask really good questions. So if you say, like, you know, there's a question like, did humans evolve with God's help? You know, like, and I'm like, whoa, like, I don't even know what that means, you know? Like,
yeah.
I mean,
you
know.
Could believe in evolution and also believe in God.
That's a complicated... Exactly, yeah. Do the planets go around the sun with God's help? I mean, bring in the theologians. I don't know how to deal with that. But you know, there certainly are... there are these organizations, the Discovery Institute, the Institution for Creation Research. There are just these big organizations, well-funded, that have been around for decades. And they're still here, and they're still doing their thing, and they're still trying to get schools to either to teach creationism or to scare the teachers into not teaching evolution. Like, it's too much of a hassle, so I don't want to deal with it. And that just makes me sad because, like, you know, here I am, like, writing about tiny humans, you know, and, like, all this amazing stuff about evolution. Like, I cannot keep up with the news on evolution. It is so exciting and so important, you know, in terms of, like, understanding how the antibiotic resistance evolves and so on. There's so much to learn and to enjoy, and to think that people are just shut out of it because they're like, oh, well, if I believe that makes me a bad person. That's just unfortunate. So I'm not sure how many people are now, but there are too many. If people ask me questions about how evolution works, I'm happy to talk about that. But, you know, you after a while, you learn to recognize the people who are asking you questions in good faith and bad faith.
Mm-hmm.
And if people ask me questions in bad faith, I want them to regret it, you know.
Have you found that there's any response to evolutionary skeptics that seems to work or that seems to be a good way to kind of bridge the gap between maybe somebody who's evolution curious and,
evolution is not an intuitive thing. It's kind of weird, but there are... It's pretty straightforward to explain, and You know, and I like, if I'm just sort of in the middle of trying to write about it or talk about it, like, I'm not going to be like, here's why all you idiots are wrong. You know, like, I don't have that attitude. I'm like, hey, like, you want to know where new genes come from? That's an excellent question. And here's what scientists have been finding out. How do you go from no gene to a gene? And actually, like, scientists can see this happening. They see it happening all the time now. Like, and they can see, they can document the evolution of all sorts of genes from just jumbled DNA. So we know, and that's exciting. So I think sort of just kind of enthusiastically going into these stories of science and using new tools. So I've worked with animators to make animations about some of these evolutionary concepts, and people like it.
Yeah. I like that. You just be enthusiastic about the science.
Well, you know, otherwise you just...
Yeah.
How do you get out of bed if you're not optimistic and enthusiastic? Yeah.
Yeah. So let's talk about some of the new directions in heredity and genetics. The first thing that I think is really exciting that's been going on for the past 10 years is, or perhaps a bit more, is the field of epigenetics, which is really calling into question this whole nature-nurture debate. Once again, for the 900th time, we have to keep revisiting that question. So can you talk a little bit about that, the sort of the origins of epigenetics and what it's teaching us about nurture as well as nature?
So genetics is the science of our genes, and epigenetics is the science of how we use those genes. And you have the same genome in all your cells. It's just one genome, basically, with some interesting exceptions. But a cell in your skin of your hand is not the same as a cell in your brain. I mean, they look different. They work differently. You would not want a bunch of skin cells in your head. That would be bad. So what's happening is that at some point in your development, a whole bunch of genes shut down in your skin cells, and only certain skin-related genes were kept switched on, and then some basic genes. And then in your brain, these neurons would switch on a different combination of genes, and it's stable. And it stays stable. When the cells divide, it's still stable. And that has to do with how, you know, for example, you can silence a gene just by kind of winding it up around a spool, basically. And so it's just trapped in there. So that's epigenetics. But then our experiences can actually, like, change that pattern a bit. And so you can wake some genes up or silence some genes and through experiences. And when I say experience, I mean everything from, like, you know, your parents are smoking as they're picking you up out of the crib, to the food you eat, to, you know, did you have a lot of stress growing up, or just all sorts of different things. And so that can actually program your biology for decades to come through epigenetics. What your genes are, you know, your genes don't really do anything just on their own. They are being influenced by your environment, and epigenetics might help to explain how that happens. And then the really controversial sort of add-on to that is, like, okay, let's say that your epigenetics change in your life. Could you pass that down to kids? You know, so if parents experience stress, trauma, so on, does that affect how the genes of their children work? Do they pass that down to the next generation? It's very powerful and engaging, and sort of you can kind of think about families where, yeah, that might make sense. But that's not science. So if you're a plant, the answer is totally yes. Like epigenetics in plants is really well studied, and
so if you scare a plant, then the next generation.
You know,
of
what's scary for a plant is a caterpillar.
Right.
So a
lack of water.
Right. Exactly. Yes. You're a plant and you can't move, so you're like, I'm being eaten by caterpillars, or oh, there's no water and I can't go get a glass. So plants will respond by ramping up certain chemicals that they sort of can they can make, like they can make toxins to kill off the caterpillar. And the seeds that these plants produce will actually be sort of produce plants that are primed to make the toxins faster, and the same for the next generation. There are also it looks like you can, you know, there's some animals like tiny worms where it looks like they can learn certain things about their environment, and then that gets passed down to their next generation. Yeah, so this is a different kind of heredity. So heredity exists in several different channels. You know, there's genetics, there's culture we talked a bit about, there's epigenetics in some cases, and then there are probably even others.
Yeah, it's so interesting. I read about a study that showed that mice could also inherit. It was sort of if the grandmother mouse had been deprived of food or stressed, that it kind of passed on.
Yeah.
Is that reputable or?
Well,
or is it just worms and plants really?
So when you get to the mice, that's where people really start to get worked up about it.
Because we're mammals, they're
mammals. We're mammals, yeah. But also, like, the group number of mice are small, and they haven't really replicated these studies. There's this one study, a really remarkable one, where basically they would take these male mice and they would blast them with a whiff of an odor, kind of an almond-like odor, and then shock them. And they would just keep doing this until they, as soon as they smelled that odor, they'd be like, oh, here it comes. And then they basically did IVF with the sperm of those male mice. And so all that the pups were getting from them was just the sperm. And it looked as if their offspring were acting kind of funny when they were exposed to that smell. So you're like, wow, like, you know, you could pass, your parents could pass down their learned fears to you.
But it's mice.
That study's never been replicated.
Okay, yeah. So this is a good lesson, and this is part of why Carl is such a good science journalist, is that he's sort of contextualizing the study and saying, like, you know, mice are not people, and also you have to replicate the study in order for it to actually be something that's legit. That's kind of how science works.
Yeah, you know, I mean, sometimes you do wonder with skeptics, like, what will ever really satisfy them? And you know, but there hasn't been any, there have been studies on humans, and there it gets really tough because we live a long time, and it's so it's just really hard to sort of see these effects going through generations. And there the arguments get even stronger.
So. Yeah, it's murky.
Jury's out.
Yeah.
But, you know, you can still go and, like, buy a book, you know, learning how to do psychotherapy to undo the trauma from your grandparents. I mean, epigenetics has really, like, just penetrated popular culture, really way beyond what the science can tell us, I think.
Yeah. So speaking of things that have penetrated pop culture way beyond the science, let's talk a little bit about CRISPR.
Mm.
A lot of people, you know, have fantasized for a long time about altering the human genome and making us, you know, impervious to fire and grow wings. And, like, we're all going to become the X-Men, basically. And then,
do you have a CRISPR novel in the works?
No. I mean, I saw the movie Rampage, where I learned that, you know, you can create giant gorillas with CRISPR in space. So I'm satisfied that I know everything. That was my first CRISPR sci-fi movie that I saw. I was pretty excited. But I do think that the general public kind of thinks that about CRISPR and imagines that it's like that you really could create someone who is impervious to fire. So tell us the actual tale of what CRISPR can do and what we can kind of expect from it.
So CRISPR is sort of is one of the latest technologies for changing DNA, and the advantage of it is that it's quick, it's cheap, and it's pretty accurate. And you couldn't say that with methods before.
So when you say changing DNA, you mean sort of engineering new DNA? You mean editing actually existing DNA?
Yeah. So, like, let's say that there's like a letter, a base in a gene that you want to take that out. You can. So what CRISPR can do is just go snip and then just put the pieces back together. Or you can go snip and now you have this gap and you can drop in a little piece of DNA that you've synthesized and it'll go in there where it was.
So if someone has a genetic disease, that might be really fantastic.
Right. So there are clinical trials going on right now for sickle cell anemia, horrific disease, which is caused by inheriting two faulty copies of a gene for hemoglobin in the blood. And so the idea is that you could take stem cells out of patients, and you could use CRISPR to snip a little bit of DNA out so that they'll start making hemoglobin that they can use. And you put the stem cells in to the patients, and they get established in their bones, and then they're going to be able to produce a steady blood supply of healthy blood. So that's happening now. I haven't heard too many people say, like, this is a terrible thing. Don't do this. You know, these people are not going to be giant crocodiles rampaging through Chicago. These are just going to be, if it works, these will be people who had sickle cell anemia and then don't. So that's good.
Yeah.
But what else do you want to snip out? What is your goal for snipping things out? And that's where things get complicated and dangerous.
This is Bina, KALW's series featuring artists and thinkers who've spoken at the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco. Today's guest is science journalist and author Carl Zimmer, whose new book is She Has Her Mother's Laugh. He's joined in conversation by journalist, editor, and author Anna Lee Newitz. Bina is also available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org.
What if you say, like, instead of taking a person with a disease, you say, like, all right, you know, here's this IVF embryo that my spouse and I have produced, and we don't want it to have this trait. We want it to have a different trait, and so go in there, please, and change it. And then that person is born with that change in every cell in its body and could then pass it down to the next generation. So you can change the future of heredity in this very powerful way.
So where do you think that's going? I mean, do you think people are going to start, you know, doing those kinds of edits? I know there's been already one alleged experiment.
No, not alleged. No. This happened. I mean, when I was working on the book, I was like, and maybe soon someday somebody might rashly try to make a CRISPR baby. And then the book comes out, and then about 6 months later, CRISPR babies. So a scientist in China decided to edit the DNA of at least two human embryos, implanted, born, so these kids would be almost a year old now, I guess. And the Chinese government has confirmed that he did this. He is sort of gone away, like, I don't know, house arrest or something. No one's heard from him for a year.
He was condemned internationally by the scientific community. It was not considered to be a cool thing to do.
But there's a scientist in Russia now who is saying, like, I'm going to do the same thing. And he's actually been saying what one of the things he would like to do is he would like to reach out to parents, both of whom have congenital deafness caused by a mutation, and say, like, how about we CRISPR your IVF embryo so that your child is not deaf? So now we're getting into much more complicated terrain, you know, because, you know, deafness was considered by eugenicists to be like something that made people unfit, you know, that they ought to be sterilized for that. And people were. But the deaf people today see themselves as part of a community with a language and a culture, and now people are coming in with CRISPR and saying, like, we can just, like, just, you know, get rid of that community.
Is it scientifically possible to get rid of it? Because one of the things about the Chinese babies was that the doctor was trying to eliminate a gene that would make them, add a gene that would make them
He was going to cut out a little bit of a gene that, and that it's a gene that's on the surface of a protein on the surface of our cells. Mm-hmm. And there are people, you know, some of you probably have this particular deletion. Mm-hmm. And if you have two copies of this gene with a deletion, you pretty much cannot get infected with HIV. That's a fact.
Okay.
And actually, like, the NIH has been thinking about supporting a CRISPR therapy for people who get infected with HIV to, like,
put that deletion
into their bodies, you know?
So he put that deletion into the infants, to the embryos.
Yes.
Yeah. And so do we have any evidence that it worked? Or?
We have no evidence at all. Yeah.
So that was the plan.
Yeah.
So
yeah. It was a complete fiasco.
So to the deafness question, is that also something that is sort of speculative or?
Well, he hasn't done it, but he has
some genes that he's going to target.
Well, yes. Yeah. So for example, a journalist named John Cohen from Science Magazine went to Moscow and spoke to some parents who had been contacted by the scientist. They've had genetic testing. They know that they both have a mutation on the same gene. So they know that their kid could be deaf like them, and they would rather that their kid wasn't.
So they're going to try it out, maybe?
They're not sure. And it's not clear the Russian government is going to let this happen. So this is something, what the future of CRISPR depends a lot also on what governments decide. There's another technique I talk about called the three-parent baby, where basically you take a woman's chromosomes and put them in another woman's egg because there's DNA in outside of the chromosomes, and then you fertilize that. And so, in a sense, you have three parents.
And that's been done.
Yes, that's been done. It hasn't been done here, but there was a scientist from New York who flew to Mexico to do this on a couple who wanted it done so that their child would not have these really terrible diseases. I don't think that the CRISPR babies are going to be here, but mm-hmm. I think rich people will just fly to, I don't know, Singapore, Abu Dhabi or someplace and get it done there.
Moscow. So do you, to sort of bring this all the way back to these questions around how culture shapes our science, do you think that this could be leading us toward a new eugenics age, but one where we actually have the science to make those kind of terrifying dreams come true?
I don't, only because, people sometimes say, like, oh, we're going to make a new species. And I'm thinking, like, like, let's really think about this. Like making a new species, like, that's a lot of work. And it takes a lot, you know, if you were to try to, like, split Homo sapiens into two species that could not reproduce together, oh, my gosh, like, it would take such a crazy industrial scale of CRISPR engineering. And plus, like, you'd have to make sure that no one was having sex between the populations.
That always works.
And we know, yeah, we know that never, you could never do that anyway, so... Just I get sort of when I think to me this starts to get into the realm of science fiction, but I get hung up on the logistics. Mm-hmm. You know, are you telling me really that like there will be like a billion people who will get IVF and do CRISPR and all that? And mm-hmm. you know, like IVF itself is like it's a lot of work and really expensive. So I what I'm concerned about is a sort of I'm more concerned about a eugenics mindset.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, that. And I talk about this a bit in the book that in the 100 years ago, there were people whose lives were destroyed by the eugenics mindset. You know, saying looking at people and saying, like, well, you are the way you are because of what you inherited, and therefore, sorry, there's nothing we can do for you. And we're not going to think about sort of the social factors that we might have had a hand in creating the environment in which you grew up. So, you know... So rather than getting let out of the water, we're just going to say, well, this is just, sorry, there's no, you know, human nature is what it is, you know. That's what concerns me more, actually, is this more so the eugenics mindset. And CRISPR kind of gives it a nice, fancy polish,
mm-hmm. you know. It definitely plays into that fantasy that there's some people who could get, you know, this treatment. Maybe they wouldn't become another species, but... They could become longer lived, or they could be immune to certain conditions, or.
So I think this sort of like, you know, wanting to enhance your kids. It's sort of like, I think of it kind of as like sort of like the SAT prep on steroids kind of view of parenting. But I don't think it'll work. And I think it won't work because that's not how intelligence works. That's not how, you know, athletic, you know, skill doesn't work that way. You know, like I found in my genome, I actually got a report. One of my reports on my genome says, you know, you are genetically, your muscles are genetically programmed for power. And I was, yeah. You didn't have to, you could have like sort of hidden your expression. But yes. Anyone who knows me knows that my muscles are not built for power.
I just liked the idea that there was like a way that you could just sort of inherit all forms of power. Like it would just be like social power will be yours.
Right, all mine. So there is a gene that seems to be unusually common in championship athletes. Okay.
Fine. And you have that?
I've got it. But it turns out that just having one gene that is a bit more common than you'd expect in championship athletes does not alone make you a championship athlete. So
yeah.
Yeah. It's so that Rampage movie, not going to happen, you know?
Yeah. So. No, it's definitely not going to happen. Okay, on that note, we can open up for questions from the audience.
So you talked a little bit how we're rushing headlong into a CRISPR world of gene editing. I'm interested in where are you seeing the best, whether it's like ethical or policy, like frameworks and thinking happening in this space? And do you see any hope for us doing this in a way that's at all thoughtful?
I would say that the thoughtlessness gets all the headlines, and the careful, foresight and people having discussions and trying to bring in lots of stakeholders, that doesn't get the headlines. So like, there's this someone at MIT named Kevin Esfeld. He would like to use CRISPR on the mice. I believe it's Nantucket. Basically wants to sort of engineer the mice so that they will not be able to transmit ticks. Lyme disease will not be able to circulate between the mice and the ticks, and so people won't get Lyme disease there. But, you know, he doesn't want to do this without just on his own, you know. So, like, he has been having lots of meetings with the communities there, like saying, look, this is what we can do. This is why we think it would be valuable. This is, you know, what do you think? Do you want to do this? Do you have questions? I know Jennifer Doudna at Berkeley has, you know, she from the start was like, when she was pioneering CRISPR, saying like, this could be great and this could be really not great, and got a sort of a global conversation going. So those kinds of things are heartening, but then, you know, it doesn't take a whole lot of people to wreak a lot of havoc, you know. Someone can just go open up a clinic in Moscow and off to the races.
CRISPR are us.
Yeah. Well, you know, stem cells is the same thing. You know, you have these ridiculous stem cell clinics making all sorts of ridiculous promises. And, you know, stem cell biologists are really like good scientists and they're doing incredible work. And then you have people who are just going off and just harming the whole field.
So given the conversation you had, especially looking at mice and trying to correlate the reality of epigenetics, back in the day, there was this, I think, well-known study about famine survivors in Holland in 1944 and their children showing that. And I'm wondering, in the course of the last, you know, 50 years, has the view of that study changed and it's more indicative or considered more proof of epigenetics actually exist? And then the second part is, I'm kind of curious about your thoughts about gene drive technology, especially with letting that loose into, let's say, mosquito populations or other things.
Okay. All right. The Dutch winter famine. So the Dutch starved during World War II, and then, the women who were pregnant, obviously at the time, were under a lot of stress, and then they had children, and their children had been tracked in terms of their health for a long time. And I've written about some of the research that's been done even just recently. And some people have argued that you can see an epigenetic signature in the kids. And, you know, they're again, it's a small group of people, so it's hard to tell if those differences are statistically meaningful. And also, you know, it might not necessarily be that sort of the epigenetics changed, but that, you know, you have lots of different kinds of cells in your body, and each kind of cell has different epigenetics. So maybe these kids, they just, you know, they had a some of their cells, just the populations got bigger and some got smaller, and it looked like it was a change in the epigenetics. It's a subtle point, but it's an important one because it's hard to tell what's going on. That's all I'm saying. As for gene drive, so gene drive is basically where you take the CRISPR gene, the CRISPR system, and you put it in the genes of an animal. And basically what that can do, I write about this in the book in more detail, but basically you override Mendel's law. So let's say you have a mosquito, you engineer it so that it cannot carry malaria. Not a bad idea. Now you've got another, if it mates with another mosquito, normally like only half of their offspring would inherit that altered gene. So what gene drive does is basically ensure that they all inherit it. So what that means is, in theory, is that you could release several hundred of these engineered mosquitoes into a region that has lots of malaria, and in a matter of a couple years, all the mosquitoes would be resistant to malaria. That's the idea. And so there are people who, I mean, I've gone into a lab here, not too far from here in Irvine, where these mosquitoes are flying around. So now the question is, do we set them loose? You know, is that dangerous to the bigger ecosystem to do this? You know, would something else happen? You know, no one has answered those questions to anyone's full satisfaction, but we shall see. We could see it someday being used for treating malaria, for getting rid of Lyme disease. Kevin Esfeldt in Nantucket wants to do this. It's potentially very powerful, but the big question is, like, once you set it loose, there's probably no taking it back.
That's a good way to end.
Yeah. Thank you.
Bina is a co-production of the Jewish Community Center of San Francisco and KALW. For more information about programs at the JCCSF, you can visit jccsf.org. Today's guest was science journalist and author Carl Zimmer, whose new book is She Has Her Mother's Laugh. He was joined in conversation by journalist, editor, and author Anna Lee Newitz. The recording engineers at the JCCSF are Ben Bernardi, Alex Espalet, Dan Folds, Carly Mari, and Aiden Nelson. David Kwan edits and produces the program, and Tina Pimentuan is the executive producer. Our theme music is from the album Masada Rock by the Rashanim Trio, and the music you're hearing right now is by John Zorn. Bina is available as a podcast, and you can find it at kalw.org. I'm Jordan Abel. Thanks for listening.